My name is James Burnham. This is my podcast. It's called Failing Into Success. And I have with me today one of my favorite guys, Shaquille Walker. Shaq, I got to know, fortunately, through my niece, who he married. So fortunate enough to get to know you that way. But great guy. I think I'd have liked you if I bumped into you on the street regardless.
I think we would have been good friends. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So anyway, Shaq has had a pretty great career. He's still a young guy. He's not even in his 30s yet. But he finished his undergraduate degree. When I first met him, he was thinking about being a dentist. So he was studying pre-med, working really hard, great academic performance. And then you dropped out of the standard academic process at BYU, where you were a track athlete and, in fact, a star of the team. You won a very prestigious award in 2016, didn't you? What was that award?
Yeah, so in 2016, I got the Curtis Pugsley Award for BYU, which is basically the MVP for the team. But there were a couple other international competitions I did as well. But that, in terms of BYU experience or accolades, that was probably the biggest one for me.
Yeah, which is cool. And I wanted you to say the award because I just thought it sounded really stupid. So I didn't want to say it myself.
You're like, did I get it right? Is this right?
But only two athletes on the team get it in a year. So a pretty significant achievement, along with, you know, a world record holder in the outdoor 800 meter track race.
Yeah. On the road. Yeah, the road 800 meter. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you were, what was your best time in the track and field? It was like 144.99 or something like that. Is that correct?
Yep. That's spot on. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Super fast. I mean, I can run about 100 meters in that time. So I know.
Me too now.
Fast. I think it's awesome to be able to sit with somebody who's achieved something that's really a world-class effort. I mean, you were running at a level that allowed you to run professionally for the last 2 years of your degree. You toured Europe, you ran, what an opportunity that was. And then to go on with what Shaq has done, he got back, he decided he wanted to go into business, started working on a business with some friends, gets on Shark Tank, pitches their product, they get picked up. Product is fantastic, professional athletes using it. And then decides he wants to do an MBA, applies to a number of schools, doesn't get where he wants to go. So he takes his fail-safe and gets a job with Bain as a consultant, one of the top consulting firms in the world. So your failures are really, in my mind, sometimes some of the best successes somebody could wish for. So impressive failure, yeah, Shaq, when you don't get into grad school and you go to work for Bain. this is the guy I'm talking to today. And so we are going to be talking about some of the failures that you've encountered and what you've learned along the way. So just before we started this, you were mentioning to me that when you were applying to Harvard for grad school for your MBA program, you actually wrote an article listing some of the failures that have been a pattern in your life and how you've leveraged them. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that essay and what you were saying?
Yeah, for sure, James. You know, first off, I actually want to say thanks for having me on the podcast. I consider it a great privilege. I've loved hearing from you and learning from you in this arena. So I think it's a real honor to be on the podcast. I think failure in my mind is just a really critical and essential piece for anyone who's going to try to accomplish anything, and certainly anything substantial. And so part of my experience of having these kind of breakthroughs or these exciting things happen to me has been those things usually come on the back end of, at least, a dozen failures or more. And so for me, I've traditionally looked at failure as a way to actually get to that point. And just to give you a few examples, it's been this principle or this overarching kind of experience of failure throughout my whole life. And so when I can go all the way back to, when I was in the fourth grade, actually, and I'm an identical twin, you know that. And my twin and I were very competitive educationally. And so anything he did, I wanted to make sure, I could do as well. If he got an A, I wanted an A.
Yeah.
And one of the earliest memories that I have of, of really failing in something that really meant a lot to me was for this program called SEEK. It was S-E-E-K. And basically it was this, you know, early educational program that would put you on an honors track. And they started it in the fourth grade, where in the state I was living in at the time. And so you have to take a test, and there's like, you know, it's kind of a weird test. It's like different shapes and how do you think? And it's just trying to test just the way you think. Anyway, my twin ended up passing the test in the fourth grade and I didn't. And I'll never forget. I came home and I was like, I'm not going to be in the honors courses, and my twin is. And I just remember crying. For some reason, it hurt so bad.
Yeah.
But it kind of was the first and kind of like this first failure, this really big failure in my life that helped me to realize that, hey, failure actually isn't the end. It doesn't matter if, you know, I didn't achieve my goal, whatever it was. But what matters is how do I respond to the failure? And so the next year, of course, you know, I worked harder than I ever had in school, and I focused more than I ever did. I didn't consider myself less than my twin because he was an honor and I wasn't. I just said, hey, I'm going to work hard and hopefully it gives me the result I'm looking for. Until the next year I got in, right? And that's the first story, but it eventually ends up, you know, going through these failures and arriving at this point where, you know, I'm at the Olympic trials.
Right.
And I've worked for literally a decade, running almost every day for a decade, minus a 2-year break that I took. But I was working, you know, this was the goal. This was the dream. I'm going to make the Olympic team. And in 2016, it looked like everything was, I mean, frankly, everything was lining up for that. I had run the third fastest time in the U.S. I had run a top 15 time in the world in the 800 meter. I felt like my best was yet to come. I was healthy. I didn't have any injuries, no nagging pains, nothing. And it was lining up to be kind of that my moment where all of this worked over
totally
a decade.
Like I was down in Vegas betting on you. I lost a lot of money.
Exactly. You're like, thanks, Shaq. I appreciate it. But this whole experience of getting to that point after failing so many times and you know, having so many bad races and so many injuries and making so many mistakes in running. And finally I'm at the Olympic trials and I'm, you know, slated to make the team and I'm feeling great. But what ends up happening, to make a long story short, is I'm also happy to go into details, but I end up, you know, the story, getting stepped on from behind, tripped. I end up appealing, and there's this lengthy appeal process that doesn't end up getting granted. There's some drama around this. And for me, it was like I was living that fourth grade horror or that fourth grade nightmare of not getting into SEEK all over again, except this time it felt even more painful because it was a decade of work and everything I had been working towards for so long. And so luckily for me, I had kind of gotten used to this pattern of failing. And saying, look, every time I fail, if I keep going, I might fail a couple more times, but there's always something right around the corner where this work is not meaningless because I didn't achieve the goal. It still was part of a process that can lead to something else and necessary, I would say. And so the cool side of this story is, you know, you failed to make the Olympic team, which meant now I wasn't going to be racing the next day in the final. Of the Olympic trials. And so I said, there's got to be another opportunity. And so I called my agent. I said, is there anything else you know that you know of? Like, I'm in shape. I'm not done yet. I have more to give. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, there's actually a race right around the corner in Springfield. We were in Eugene. He said, there's a race in Eugene, Oregon. He said, there's a race in Springfield, Oregon, literally, you know, 10 miles away. It's a road 800 meter race. There's some good, you know, there's some good prize money. Maybe you could go race in that. And I said, time yet. I was on fire. I wanted to prove I should have been on the Olympic team. And I went out there and I ended up winning that race, but I also ended up breaking the world record in the road 800 meter.
That's
and so,
awesome.
and so for me, it was,
I didn't realize that those stories were like back to back like that. Wow.
Yeah, it was literally 2 days later. It was 2 days later. And so
world
for
record
me, it was
holder.
Like,
screw you, Nike and Eugene.
So, you know, like for me, that's how I felt. I was like, you know, screw the world. The whole world's against me.
Yeah.
Like, I cannot believe this. But honestly, my dad was there and he's part of the reason why I've grown up with this feeling that, you know, failing's just part of it. And he said, well, son, you'll get them next time. And I remember the day he said that, which was like a couple hours after the appeal was denied. And I was like, Dad, just no, like, yeah. There is no next time. You don't understand. It only happens every 4 years. I could be out of my prime in 4 years or not running. You know, just having that grounding voice and it helped me to say, you know, failing is part of the process, but in my experience, there's always something around the corner if you keep pressing and you keep going. I hope that answers your question, part of your question.
No, that's a great story. I love that story. The thing that kind of hits me though, that I think a lot of people, you know, I think that sometimes we get hit with failures that are so substantial. Like, it's hard when you tell this story now, I think it's hard to carry the emotion that you must have felt after preparing for a decade. I mean, honestly, when you didn't get through, when that whole fiasco happened, I was watching this whole thing going through it peripherally, right? I wasn't there. But man, I could have like curled up in bed and been sucking my thumb for a month just hearing about it. It was devastating, right? So I think that not everyone has the capacity to even do a switch like you did that next day, to just go from, you lost a dream, a substantial dream that you had dedicated a huge portion of your life. And in the next day, you took that out on another race and pivoted and changed directions, right? That's a that's a pretty impressive skill right there, because I'm pretty sure I was still in bed that next day crying that you didn't, that now I'm not going to know somebody running in the Olympics,
right? Like, this is all stupid. This sucks. I mean, it's funny because like looking back, I didn't know I was going to go and run well in that race. You know, part of me was like, my heart's in it. You know, I just want to prove that I had the legs to make the Olympic team. And I didn't have a goal to break the world record on the roads that day. I just wanted to go and show that I was in shape, and I didn't want to waste the effort that I had put in the entire season in the past decade. And I was in the best shape of my life. And but I do think I like that you called it a skill. You said, you know, that's a cool skill you have, or an incredible skill to be able to pivot. And I think it is a skill, but I don't think it's a skill that just, I don't think it's a skill that just happens. I think you have to be actually intentional about it. And so, for me, it's almost like this principle of just believing that the failure has a purpose and that it's not all meaningless because you didn't get your goal. Which takes us to kind of this deeper principle of performance psychology, which I'm a big fan of, and I know you are, of, just having to understand that it's not always about the outcome. It's not always about that specific, you know, narrow goal that you have in your mind. Because oftentimes, you know, you're not going to hit that very specific narrow goal. But if you can take the failure in stride and you can understand that it has a purpose, then almost always that I've seen, I end up hitting a different goal that I didn't have necessarily in mind that somehow ends up being better for me in my life. And so, I think it's learning to take these failures in stride. And the only way to do that is to try to change the way you think about failure, which is, you know, to your point, James, failure is not just like this thing that ruins your dreams and crushes your soul. More failure, I think, is actually a path forward. It's actually a way to accomplish something maybe better for you if you have that mindset about it.
So here's a question, and I don't know, I have a process for when I face failure that I go through, like crushing failure, because we face failure every day. I mean, I, you know, driving to work today, I failed the signal and cut somebody off and, you know, stuff like that. Right? I mean, those type of things, those are like water off my back. We're all, you know, we all have different levels that we can cope with. But for me, when I have a crushing failure, something that just knocks me off my feet, there's a process that I follow to get myself in a state where I can be mentally agile and emotionally agile enough to do that pivot, to be able to let go of what I was looking at or break down what I was doing and recognize I wasn't quite right here. or whatever, right? Like really breaking it down and then getting myself into the mental state to be able to do that instead of, because for me at least, and this isn't the case for everybody, but I think we all have a bit of it. But for me, when I have a crushing failure, my internal dialogue, I have to be careful with, because it will turn on me. And all of my accolades, anything good that I have ever done is now gone. And I am a worthless piece of shit. That's how I feel, quite honestly, right? And so how do you make that pivot? What's your process? That's a long way to get to your question.
No, I think that's a great question. And I appreciate the buildup. For me, it, you know, I'll tell another story to kind of answer this question. So my freshman year in college, I was coming out of high school. I was a good runner in high school, but I wasn't, you know, a great runner. I was a good runner.
Two-time state
and
champ,
I remember,
right? So
I was a two-time state champ. Yeah.
Well, I don't know what great,
but I wasn't,
but in
you know,
my book, that's pretty fucking great. And I get to swear, this is my podcast.
Exactly. You're like, I can do what I want. You know, I guess I wasn't, you know, relative. I was a good runner. And so I get to college and all of a sudden I'm getting, you know, just destroyed in these races. And remember, I had lost three races my entire high school career.
Right.
And then all of a sudden I wasn't winning a single race.
Right.
And so for me, it was all of a sudden like, oh, it was a dramatic change. And like you said, my thoughts started getting to me like, maybe you're not meant for this. Maybe you're actually not that good. You're good in the small pond, but as soon as you start playing against the real boys, you know, you're worthless. You're no good. Like maybe you're just, you don't have the talent. You don't have the work ethic. And honestly, that was a really, my entire freshman year, that was a struggle with some of the thoughts that I had. There was a really defining point though. It was my freshman year, the end of the season, I went to what's called regionals. It's a regional race where half of the U.S. comes together and the top 12 go to the national race, which is like the ultimate goal for a college runner, to go to nationals. And I remember going there and I was feeling good. I was feeling healthy and I had been running okay. And I felt like my best was yet to come. And I went there and I got dead last in my race. Dead last. I ran a time. I ran the slowest time I had run all year by 4 seconds.
Oh my gosh. That is not the direction that you're headed.
I know. You're like, I thought you were going to say this great victory. So basically it was just this crushing, embarrassing
end
defeat.
Of the year.
End of the year, just finished it with, you know, the end of the collegiate season. And it was just devastating, just a complete failure. And I remember at that moment thinking, how have I got here? Like what has happened?
Sure.
And you know, I kind of had this awakening where I sat down with myself and I thought, what's gone wrong here? And I found the pattern of, you just talk bad about yourself. You just talk bad about your performance. You view your performance purely on the lens of what was the result. So it doesn't matter if your mechanics were good. It doesn't matter your running mechanics, meaning it doesn't matter if your placement was good, if you ran a strategically sound race. If you win, it's good. If you don't win, it's bad. And I realized that was, you know, just the wrong thinking and I had to have a radical shift. And so I actually started meeting with a performance psychologist and we started this long-term process of saying,
what was his name, Charlie? Was it Charles?
It was Craig Manning.
Craig Manning.
Yeah.
I read his book I forgot his name, but
yeah,
he's a great
performance psychologist. Yeah. Great, incredible book. The Fearless Mind. And he's worked with a lot of great athletes and his point was, you have to get out of this destructive mentality of saying every time that the journey is defined by the outcome. The journey is not defined by the outcome. The journey is actually defined by the journey. And so it began this process of, you know, being very intentional with after every practice, I would write down three things that I did well and one thing that I could do better. Not something I did bad, because that's how your mind starts to get you. If you did it bad and you're bad at this. And so
it's your opportunity to improve.
You know, yeah, exactly. And even, I mean, I saw immediate results like within a month after that race where I got dead last, I won the USA Junior National Championship and ended up representing the USA in Barcelona in July of that year. This is back in 2012. And I said, wow, there's something to this. And so when I then took a 2-year break of running, but when I came back, and started running again, I was very intentional with meeting with Craig and talking about these things. And it became a long-term process that had to fundamentally change the way I thought about failure and the way I thought about achieving goals, which is kind of weird because it's like, you know, it's this weird kind of like thing where you're trying to achieve this goal, but you understand that the achievement of the goal is not the value. It's actually right. the journey to get to the goal. It seems very backwards and counterintuitive. But it's the only way, I think, to really train your mind and to prevent yourself from falling in these patterns of self-destructive language where you think you're worthless if you don't, if you fail, right? That's where it comes from. You're so anchored on the outcome that you think if you fail, that you're not worth anything. When in reality, it's like, hey, what have I gained and improved at and picked up along the way? And if I achieve the goal, then that's bonus and that's nice. But really, the journey was really where the happiness was found. There's a lot of different philosophers who have really, you know, catchy quotes on this topic, and it's sure. because it's true. I think it's the journey.
I love I laughed halfway through because I realized I was initially doing this on my computer and I attached those headphones to my computer Bluetooth. And I kept thinking, this sounds really weird, this conversation with my headphones. And I just realized, yeah, my headphones aren't working. This is all on my phone.
That's awesome.
So I'm failing into success. Eventually, I'll do one of these podcasts, and I'll have everything lined up, but not today.
There it is. Yeah, there it is. And then the tech, well, then it'll be like, oh, man, well, you know, now it's powerful because you have this object lesson of like, look, we're doing it live. Here you go.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a really fantastic story. I love the concept that you were taught to quit saying I did horrible. Right. And breaking it down, looking at what you did well and something to improve on. That's it. That's a fundamental coaching technique that I use with people that yeah. I've worked with.
Yeah.
And it is astonishing the amount of progress someone can make when you approach, you know, my big thing is 4-1, 4 good things to 1 negative, never out, yeah. no matter what the person yeah. says or their capacity is for taking on criticism. Don't do it. I've never seen it work to your benefit.
Yeah, it doesn't.
You don't want to crush somebody. And so if you think of that, like I tell a story of actually coaching my daughter, Sunny, at Bear Lake just this last summer. Mm-hmm. She wanted to water ski. And I love teaching water skiing. I'm like super jazzed yeah. about it. And she asks me to do it, her dad. Which my kids don't want me to coach them. So like, I'm just, I dive in the water with her, right? I'm pumped. She's going skiing and we get her in position. I got her legs all bent and helping her with her form. And we say, hit it. And the boat takes off and her legs splay out and she flops right on her face. And I always ask people at that point, right? What if I said to my daughter, you idiot. I can't believe you just did that. That was pathetic. What a worthless attempt.
Yeah.
Guaranteed, right? That kid is out of the water, never going to ski again, maybe never talk to yep. me again, right?
Exactly.
Of course, that's not what a dad does to their kid. Mm-hmm. And I say to her, that was awesome, because it was. I was so excited that she tried, yep. and I was so impressed mm-hmm. with what I saw that she did well, and I gave her a bunch of pointers of what she did, and then I gave her one tweak. Anyway, she got up that yep. day just for like a couple seconds, not long, but she did get up mm-hmm. and she probably tried 15 times in that Bear Lake water yeah. without a wetsuit. And I was so impressed yeah. with how strong she was and her fortitude, right? Mm-hmm. And really, that's the opportunity you're giving yourself when you start talking kindly to yourself, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think there's like this. Yeah, sorry, you go on.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I think there's just, it's funny because a lot of people will think, oh, this sounds like this, you know, pseudoscience that's like, mm-hmm. that can't be real. But I've seen it work too many times. I've seen too many athletes and business people and, you know, just in every field, really, applying these very simple principles of enjoying the journey and learning how to really talk to yourself and learning how to think about failure. And I've seen it just completely unleash potential that has been there all along, and people just accomplish extraordinary things. Even if it's not, you know, let's say it's not something extraordinary in the grand scheme of things, it's personally extraordinary for that person. It's something that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to do it. I love hearing those stories, because I think the more that people can hear these stories and kind of get in a mind space where they might say, maybe there's something to this, maybe I'll give it a try. I think the more people will actually experience the things we're talking about and have the kind of extraordinary results and the kind of extraordinary transformations personally that they want to have. But you're right. It only comes from really thinking about yourself in the right way and really being intentional in how you talk to yourself.
Right. So without throwing any shade on Nike and its influence on the Olympic trials, you know, Nike is an institution. I will throw shade on them because that's who I am. But without forcing you to do that, because what a complex, I mean, there's a lot of complexity to the way that you did not qualify for the Olympics beyond your performance, mm-hmm. right? And that mm-hmm. in and of itself raises feelings of deep injustice being done, lack of good ethics from, you know, people that you would expect a better showing, mm-hmm. like all these kind of feelings that drum up beyond your own performance.
Yeah.
Right. So that can really, really, for me at least, right? Like when I fail at something, if I did my best, my very best, I performed at my peak and I fail, it actually isn't very hard for me to look at that and say, okay, what are the things I did well? And what can I improve on? But when I have a situation like what yours was, where I don't even feel like I get my chance to truly perform.
And it wasn't my fault.
There's a lot of stuff that I have to work through to pivot. So I wanna decompress that story if I can, just not on a mm-hmm. like who did what, but on an emotional level for you. What were the emotions that you had to address and deal with before you were able to get ready for a race the next day and run?
It was really hard. Because I think I had been, you know, because I had been trained in terms of performance psychology, and I had been going through this process of learning how to think in the most productive way. For, you know, it was a couple of years, 2-3 year journey of, you know, weekly meetings and daily practice. It also wasn't hard for me, you know, usually to say, regardless of the result, how did I do? And to really think about how I did objectively and find the good and pick one thing that I work on next time. It eventually wasn't hard to do that.
Right.
But that was the first situation that I was in, the Olympic trials, when I got stepped on from behind and tripped and then appealed. And, you know, there were a lot of different funky things that went on in the appeals process that, frankly, just were not allowed from the officiating side of things that, you know, I think skewed the results of if my appeal was granted or not. And that's something at the time I thought, I can never get that back. You know, I can't get this opportunity again. And it wasn't my fault. I actually ran a great race. I was in with 30 meters to go before I got stepped on. I was in second place and in position to advance no problem. And I felt great. And so it was harder for sure. But I think there was one principle that I haven't yet mentioned that pulled me back to reality. I'm not going to pretend like it was immediate. Like I was like, oh, well, performance psychology told me to do this, so I'll just do that. I didn't sleep that night at all.
Yep.
Like I just didn't sleep. The next day I went and talked to the media about what happened and felt like I really needed to say what I thought happened. And I had a bunch of friends and family, you know, just signing this petition and trying to send it over to USA Track and Field to say, look at this closer. This is ridiculous. My coach, I had two coaches at the time. They were both up in arms. It wasn't an easy situation. But by the end of that day, I had kind of come back to what I knew and said, look, this is the opportunity, that this is the chance that I have to apply all that I've been learning. And specifically the principle that really grounded me and got me back ready to look for the next opportunity, which was the very next day, was control the controllable. Control what you can control. And so for me, it was really, you know, it was not easy to say, look, I ran a great race. I was in great strategic position. Could I have done anything to prevent this? Maybe I could have been so far in front that no one could even step on me, but was right. that even wise to have done that? Probably not. I needed to conserve energy to make sure I was ready for the final, to really, when you actually run all out, right? And so, by the way, the time that made the Olympic team was a time that I had not yet run that slow all year in a final race, in a championship style race. And so it was to even see the time that made the team after that was
it was another stab.
And so for me to, I had to really remember that, you know, I've been practicing all these mental skills. I've been saying control the controllable, like it's not the outcome that matters. It's the journey of how you got there and all that you've learned and the skills that you've gained. Sure. And I just had to go back to that. It was the only option I had, right? Because otherwise, what do? You just sit there and, you know, I would have sat there and just felt sorry for myself. I would have blamed the world. I would have sworn that I'd never wear, you know, Nike socks ever again. I just would have, you know, I
don't wear Nike anymore. It's bastards.
I know a lot of people who are like, yeah, I'm never like touching Nike stuff ever again, because they, you know, Nike was it's heavily involved in the Olympic trials, and
it felt
very political.
Because of what they did to you and Steph Curry, that got me. The way they interviewed Steph Curry, I read that article. I saw what they did to you, and I was like, no, nope. Under Armour and Adidas for me.
Me and Steph, I love it.
Yeah.
But I'm up there with Steph. Yeah, you know. it wasn't easy at all. But I now, it's always, hindsight's always 20/20, you know. And at the time, I kind of thought, I need to let this go. It's for no one else, for me, I need to let this go. And I need to go and look for the next opportunity. And you know, I wish I could say after setting the world record in the road 800 meter that, you know, that a couple of days later that it was, you know, that I just felt like, okay, great, I'm good. It still kind of stung a little bit because it was something I worked for a decade, but at least I knew that I controlled what I could control. I performed well on the day. There was just, you know, frankly, just some bad luck. But now looking back, I can actually truly say, you know, on the topic of failure, that failure was good for me. If I hadn't have failed then, you know what I would have done? Probably would have made the Olympic team, would have gone to the Olympics, would have probably done okay, would have kept running, and my life just would not have been significantly different. I wouldn't have taken this lesson out of this experience. I'd get to say, yeah, I ran in Rio in 2016 as part of the U.S. Olympic team, and that's cool, and like that might get me some clout, but I wouldn't have learned these rich lessons of like, look, failure is really powerful if you actually take it and do the right thing with it. And so what that actually led to is I ended up, you know, feeling after I left running sooner than I thought I was going to. It just stopped feeling like the right thing to do, you know, a year and a half after that, which led to me starting a company with a longtime friend, which led to, you know, an appearance on Shark Tank, which led to a deal, which led to, this rich business experiences that I never would have had, which led to me thinking maybe I want to do business instead of dental school, which led to working at Bain now. And like, it's just led to so many other things that I think are going to impact me for the next 30, 40, 50 years. And making the Olympic team would have been amazing, but it's hard for me to imagine that it would have the depth of experience and lessons that I've learned from the failure.
Yeah. That's a really nice way to look at it. And I will say, like, having gotten to know you, that I think you're going to be much more happy in business than you would be as a dentist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And probably richer.
I think so, maybe. Yeah. If the businesses work out, I mean, it's been surprising. Like, it was actually a lot of tension of like, you know, that's another thing, actually. These experiences, I got to know myself, right? Like, before that, I didn't really know myself. I was focused so much on what I ought to do and what I should do that I didn't say, like, what who are you? Like, what do you want to do?
It's that gut check.
And And so like, I mean, I have no complaints. Everything's worked out really well. And I feel like I'm where I'm supposed to be now.
Good for you. I think that's I love to see it when people are able to get to that place where they can really do a gut check on what it is they really want. So one of the things that I ask people all the time is, like, when you're lying in bed and you dream at night of the things that you want, what is that thing, right?
Yeah.
And you can see a person that has really got to a place where they want to embrace that versus a person that is not ready to admit what they really want yet because they haven't figured it out. They just haven't, because they're so caught up in what everybody else wants for them. They don't know.
Yep.
And I can see it because I've spent so much time there. I was not as fast as you in making this transition. I'm really, honestly, you're one of the people that I look at and think, man alive, I hope my kids can figure it out as fast as you did.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I've completely figured it out, but I feel
of course not. No one has.
I have gotten lucky, though. I failed a lot, right? Like, failing really expedites that process, I think, because it's like, okay, that's not it. And so, you know, I, you know, that's kind of you to say, James. I really appreciate it. But it's, I think failure, you know, we've talked about this so much, and it's, the more I have these conversations with you, the more I'm like, oh, it starts to unravel itself. And you see that, wow, failure's even shaped me more than maybe I even thought or that I think sometimes. And so, I think it's got a really critical place that we somehow need to adapt and learn to say, hey, failure is okay. Fear is okay.
Yeah, I think, you know, like, I look at it and I just feel like our failures, we respond to, right? I mean, I'm sure you've gotten into the medical side of it, right? How, you know, when you hit a fight or flight response, and failure triggers that for you, right? So your amygdala kicks in, you start pumping cortisol through your body and adrenaline, and you get into that fight or flight response, and your prefrontal cortex really kind of shuts down. And so you're not capable of making the wisest decisions when you're in a state of real kind of anxiety and frustration over failure, which would explain your first 24 hours after you got kicked out of the trials, right?
Yeah.
You are in an emotional fight or flight response, and you want to lash out, right? Tons of emotions to deal with, you know?
Yeah.
Probably you probably ran the gamut in every emotion you could think of, right, during that 24 hours.
Oh man. It was hell. It was not nice for those first, especially the first like 12 hours. Like, I mean, it was not fun.
But I think that's the thing, is that pain of, like, I mean, you can just push that away, and you can, like, I was joking around, but you can hunker down in bed and just avoid and sleep away, or you can anesthetize yourself with drugs or some other activity that distracts, whatever it may be, right? And we do that. And you know what? It's okay, I think, if you're going to do that for a moment. But the problem is when you never stop.
Yep. Right? Yeah. And sooner or later, you have to face that.
Yeah. And so I think it was kind of admirable, like, you were able to take something that difficult to process in 24 hours and then just flip it and pivot into something else. That shows some really, really significant training, right? And you were with me. We were down in St. George, what, a month ago, maybe?
Yeah, a month ago now, I guess.
Almost a month ago. And I had just gone through some pretty devastating stuff myself, right? And I was struggling. I was really struggling. But just being able to step away from that for a minute and get some foundation on who I was and not live in the mistake helped me to move forward and you know, pivot and do stuff.
Yeah.
So I think we all face that, but you've got to address those emotions or they won't go away.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Yeah, and you know, I like that you mentioned, you know, like, everyone has different ways of muting it for a time or of you know, kind of making it feel like it's not there. But sooner or later, I really think that, you know, there's always going to be this reckoning where these difficult emotions will demand to be addressed, and we don't get to choose when that is. If we, you know, when it happens right away, we can choose when it, we can, we're kind of in control. We can say, well, I'm going to address this right now. But I think sometimes it seems like the longer it sits and the longer we try to, you know, not address it. Because I've definitely had hard emotional things that I was just like, I'm good. I'm not.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not even going to talk about that. And then suddenly, randomly, it demands to be addressed. And I'm not in control in those times. And so I think part of the premise of performance psychology is learning to look at the world in a way that helps you to be in control. Or said another way, which is going to sound counterintuitive, it helps you to realize that you're actually never in control.
Yeah.
that's really what
it is. There's very little that we have control over. And on really what it comes down to is we have control over our emotions, right?
Yep.
And the actions we have
control
take
over, you know, ourselves. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. And you know, it's like, it's weird because even in running, you run to win, right? Mm-hmm. Like, why else would you run in a race? You want to win the race.
No. Yeah.
Or at least, you know, right? It's weird. Or like at least beat your own time.
Yeah.
But with that being said, you actually cannot control what anyone else does in that race. And so like it's this weird conundrum of like, you have to win the race. But you actually can't control if you win the race or not. Because, I mean, speaking from experience, at, you know, 2016 National Championship, I ran probably the best race of my life and got third. You know, I brag that I'm one of the fastest. I think I'm like the third fastest non-winning, non-national champion in NCAA history.
Yeah.
You know why? Because two guys that day just had a better day.
I remember watching that. I couldn't believe it. The times were insane.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah.
They were the number one and number two collegiate time in history.
Yeah.
And then my time was the third fastest time ever on that track, which was number three that day, obviously.
Right.
And one of the fastest times in NCAA history as well. It just wasn't a win that day. And so I actually came out of that race feeling perfectly content. Like, you know what? I ran an incredible race.
Yeah.
I control what I can control. Those guys are freaks. I can't control how fast they run. No. And now I don't feel so bad because they both got on to be, you know, top five runners in the world.
Yeah.
And so now I'm like, okay, like, you know, one of them won the national champion, the world championship in just last year. And so, you know, and so does that mean I didn't do a good thing or does that mean I failed? No, it's like I control what I can control and I can't do anything else. I can't control what any other people do.
Well, all I can say is I'm really grateful that I've gotten to know you, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk to you about these things because, you know, I loved what you said about not looking at something when you fail, not looking at it as necessarily a failure, but just looking at it as a part of the journey and saying to yourself, what did I do well? And what can I improve on? You know, just one thing. And I think too often we try to, we beat ourselves up too much, you know.
Yeah.
But here's a perfect example. I mean, I people aren't going to fully appreciate what a high achiever you are necessarily because they don't know, you know, just listening. But you're somebody that has accomplished a ton in your life. You've done, you know, great things. And I know that you have, you know, failures that you hold close to your heart. I'm sure everyone does. But now I would love to see somebody that's able to take that and leverage it into something better. So I'm a fan of yours, and I hope to see a lot more from you in the future. Thanks for your time, Shaq.
Thanks, Shane. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. I mean, you know, I think you're, you know, I of everyone.
Shaq, you were going to say something really nice about me, and I think that God intervened and stopped it. You can't hear. Okay.